This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. The results of Wisconsin's presidential election and our 10 electoral votes could be decided by the state Supreme Court. The Trump campaign is asking the court to overturn Joe Biden's victory on the grounds they say that clerks in Milwaukee and Dane counties improperly issued, accepted, and counted absentee ballots. The Trump team wants the Supreme Court to throw out more than 221,000 absentee ballots. That would include all of the in-person absentee ballots cast in those counties before Election Day. The request comes after votes were recounted in those areas, a move that cost the Trump campaign $3 million. Those recounts wound up boosting Biden's win by 87 votes, putting his margin of victory at about 21,700. The results were approved by the Wisconsin Elections Commission and certified by Governor Evers on Monday. You can join in. Let us know what you make of all this at 800-642-1234. Do you think the Wisconsin election is effectively done now? What do you think of the Trump team's legal challenges and from former Trump legal team members in the state? If you voted absentee in Milwaukee or Dane counties, what do you think about the notion that your ballot could be thrown out? And what questions do you have about how all this works? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or email ideas@WPR.org. Charlie Jacobs is a professor of public law, judicial process, and American politics at St. Norbert College. Charlie, welcome back to the show.
Thanks, Rob.
Well, let's start with a recount, Charlie. As expected, the vote totals didn't change a whole lot with this recount of the state's two biggest counties. What do you think was the motivation for the Trump campaign in asking for and paying for these recounts?
Well, I think there were a couple of reasons why they were going to do this. One, in selecting these two counties, which are large by population and, of course, have a higher density of Democratic voters, they were probably trying to identify what they believed were improper votes or proper voting processes, because it's where the votes are that are going to help them to close the gap that they had on Election Day. And so I think that's one of the motivations. Second is you need an avenue by which you're going to get to a court. And so if they're going to try and undermine our faith in the way in which the votes were counted or the process that was used, you're going to have something to hang your hat on. And so these two counties were a way, I think you could fuse both of those items together in a way to vault yourself into some court and hopefully either slow down the process of certification or win outright and get the 10 Electoral College votes for the Trump camp.
Now we have the election certification, not something that usually gets a lot of attention after elections, but it became a big deal. We had the Wisconsin Elections Commission Chair Ann Jacobs sign off on Biden's win after the recounts. Republican members of that panel said she shouldn't have done it, asked for a resignation as chair. What's your read on this certification process?
I mean, a lot of this, I think, is a lot of smoke. The process that Ann Jacobs used was similar, if not exact, if my memory serves, as what was conducted in 2016 when Donald Trump won. And she's just replicating that and replicating what the guidance is for the operation. As you note, you know, this is sort of pro forma. This is in many ways just the cherry on top. The counts are made. Everyone verifies and validates it and off it goes. Now, this is more contentious. So I think some of the members of the WEC were just interested in trying to slow the process down a bit, trying to give the Trump administration a little bit more time to file a suit. But as statute seems to indicate, the certification is in essence going to be put on pause whether or not Evers signed it or not, because now an appeal to the recount has been made. And so we're sort of in this odd sort of certification purgatory of sorts, waiting until we see what the results of the appeal are going to be.
Let's talk about the court side of things. Now, we've got multiple challenges here. The Trump campaign is, I think, the main line of attack here, going to the state Supreme Court. There's a former Trump team lawyer going into federal court. There's an outside group also challenging the election to the state Supreme Court. Let's start with the effort from the Trump campaign. What case are they making here?
So it's actually sort of multifaceted. And the interesting thing is that there isn't really a claim of fraud here, per se, which is what they've been pushing around the country, at least outside of courtrooms, rather than maybe inside of courtrooms. Here, a lot of what is being discussed is process and procedure, that there have been some violations of state statute in the way in which the election was conducted. And that includes some of the ways in which individuals were granted absentee ballots or the ways in which they were able to drop off absentee ballots with officials with, say, Madison area officials. And so a lot of what they're attacking here isn't necessarily that people violated the law knowingly, but that the processes created both by the WEC and local clerks violated fundamental statute. The issue here with that is that voters are voting in good faith. They are relying on the information that they receive from local municipalities about what they're supposed to do in order to get a ballot and to submit it. And those municipal workers, those clerks, are relying on the WEC that gives them guidance about how they're supposed to behave under law, which means everybody's acting in good faith. And most of the guidance that was offered by the Election Commission has been on the books for a long time. And one of the questions that the court will certainly ask is, why didn't you bring this case sooner? Why are you waiting until now to discuss this? Because the remedies available to the court to scuttle all of these votes is rather extreme when questions of process could have been resolved in October or September or even as far back as March. And so I think that's one of the fundamental issues that's going to be raised by whatever court is dealing with these questions from the Trump campaign.
Yeah, I want to talk about, I guess, the enormity of the remedy for these technical challenges. The lawsuit says throw out over 200,000 ballots, which would flip probably the result, almost certainly the result of the election. Is there precedent for doing something like this?
Not at the presidential level that I'm aware of. I mean, there have been some recent congressional elections. There have been some local elections where, in essence, we've done a redo, some sort of playground kind of remedy where you just do it all over again. And the other issue about this remedy, I mean, you're talking about 200,000 votes, but you know, there are 70 other counties that were using the same procedures that the Elections Commission created. And it would be a conundrum for the court to say, well, we're going to throw out these votes in these two counties, but neglect the fact that we're going to rule that the process was wrong, but allow all these other votes to stand. So really, the slippery slope with the argument is all absentee ballots in the state might have to go if they persuade the judges that this is a fault in the way in which the WEC implemented this particular election.
We're talking about the certification of Wisconsin's presidential election and the Trump campaign's legal fight to overturn results. Charlie Jacobs is with us, professor of public law, judicial process, and American politics at St. Norbert College. You can join in at 800-642-1234 with your thoughts on the process, the legal challenges, and your questions, too. Call in at 800-642-1234. We'll pick up the conversation coming up on Central Time. You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. Right now, we're talking about the status of Wisconsin's presidential election. Charlie Jacobs is with us, professor of public law, judicial process, and American politics at St. Norbert College in De Pere, looking at the Trump team's legal challenges as well. You can join in at 800-642-1234. We'll go to our callers now. Bob is with us in Chippewa Falls. Bob, hi.
Hi. Say, I find it very interesting, especially what your guest says. It indicates to me the Republicans have changed their strategy from trying to meet intent with fraud to now just trying to challenge a process that's never been questioned. As far as I'm concerned, they're putting garbage in and the court is throwing garbage out. So I find that it's just total garbage what they're doing.
Bob, thanks a lot for the call. And Charlie, Republican challenges and the Trump team challenges around the country have not had a ton of success in courts with these arguments. Is that right?
Well, not with the fraud arguments. And I think in part it's because they walk in the door sort of implying that there's fraud. And then when the judges try to disentangle from the other arguments, this idea of fraud, it all sort of falls apart like a house of cards. The one reason I think at least the arguments are going to be entertained here by a court, and I don't know whether or not the Supreme Court's going to take it under their original jurisdiction or whether or not it's going to go to a circuit court, but I think that they're at least going to entertain these arguments a little bit because they are about process, and they're going to want to make sure that they're ensuring for voters themselves that they have faith that the process was met. I think what's going to be interesting is after these various cases are wrapped up, what the state legislature is going to do to either remedy ambiguities in the law or rein in the WEC and the way in which it offers guidance. Because, you know, WEC's got a lot of latitude here about how they help the clerks understand they're going to implement an election. And that's where all of these questions arise, because is it proper? Are you following statute? And who's going to resolve these disputes? It should be the legislature. And I think that's what we're going to have to lean on.
Let's go to another caller now. Jody is with us in Monona. Jody, hello.
Hi. Yeah, I was an early voter in Monona, and so was my entire family. And the idea that they could throw my legal vote as a registered voter out is really garbage. I think this is all a point to keep a whole bunch of people in this country angry and to keep getting money based on that anger. That's kind of where I'm coming from.
Jody, thanks a lot for that call. And Charlie, if people like Jody and many other 200,000 voters had their votes voided, in effect, did they then have legal recourse?
I mean, they may. And there was a suit filed in October when there were questions raised by members of the state Senate regarding the collection of ballots as sort of a way to stem arguments from Republicans about the way the process was unfolding. So it would be interesting whether or not the governor in reply to this case is going to bring up those kinds of issues, because, you know, somebody like Jody shows up to the polls, and my guess is she probably voted early before as well, because that's a pattern. You go with the notion that the clerks are telling you the process that you're supposed to use, and you assume it's valid. And the clerks, as I said before, assume it's valid because that's what the WEC told them. And for years, people have been showing up and making application for early voting, which is merely an absentee ballot, but in person. They rely on this information. And she's right to worry that even though she followed the rules as she knew them, her vote might get tossed.
Thanks for that call, Jody. In our last minute or so, Charlie, what are you watching for next as the legal process unfolds here?
I think for me, the biggest question is going to be whether or not the state Supreme Court even takes this case. And one of the issues really is that, you know, Supreme Courts don't like to take cases like this on their original jurisdiction. And by that, I mean, they take the case first because there's no record developed by a court previous and they don't have full information. And you kind of are spitballing decisions when that happens. And so I'm wondering whether or not the court is going to defer to the circuit courts to start this process and see how it unfolds before they take it up. And that's what I'm really looking for. What's the Supreme Court going to do in this case?
Charlie, thanks a lot for joining us again.
Thanks, Rob. Thanks for having me.
Charlie Jacobs is a professor of public law, judicial process, and American politics at St. Norbert College. We talked to him today about the certification of Wisconsin's presidential election results and the Trump campaign's legal fight to overturn those results. Coming up, the holiday movie is not just for fans of the Hallmark Channel, though there's nothing wrong with that. We'll learn about the rich history of the holiday movie genre and ask what you're watching this year. This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret. December 1st has come and gone, which means if you weren't already, maybe shamefully, watching holiday movies, you can shamelessly do so now. Actually, no judgment either way. Whether you've already watched the movies streaming services have been heavily marketing over the last few weeks, or your December is just a month-long Hallmark Channel celebration, the holiday movie has a surprisingly long history. You can join in at 800-642-1234. When it comes to Christmas movies and other holiday movies, which ones do you like to watch? Why do you like to watch them? Do you go back to the same ones year after year? Do they mean more to you this year than usual after the weird year? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. Jocelyn Sapaniak-Gillies is Assistant Professor of English and Film Studies at the UW-Milwaukee. She wrote the book, The Optical Vacuum, Spectatorship and Modernized American Theater Architecture. Jocelyn, welcome back to the show.
Thanks so much for having me, Rob.
When do we see the holiday movie genre first start to come out in film history?
It's pretty remarkable. Basically, as long as we've had film in the United States, we've had holiday movies, which I think is kind of astonishing for us to think about. Thomas Edison, who we think of as, you know, such an inventor, well, sometimes only half the inventor of the things that he claimed credit for, but one of the great fathers of cinema in the United States. He also created the first Christmas lights, which he strung up at his Menlo Park laboratory in 1880. But his studio produced silent Christmas shorts as early as the end of the 19th century. One of the ones that I would point to is The Night Before Christmas, which was directed by Edwin S. Porter, who works with Thomas Edison in his studio. So really as early as the days of silent cinema, we're seeing holiday movies produced. It's pretty remarkable.
So it was kind of innovative in movie technology. Is that something that went on over time where holiday movies were places to, I don't know, experiment with film technology?
Absolutely. We think of holiday movies as just something silly and fun to put on in the background. But whenever we think of something very silly and fun, that's when we know we should pay more attention to what's actually going on behind the scenes. So I think about a film like White Christmas from 1954, which is directed by Michael Curtis, a really, really well-known director. He makes one of my favorites, Mildred Pierce, the great Mildred Pierce. But many listeners might know him as the director of Casablanca. Well, he's making this film, White Christmas, in 1954, that has Danny Kaye and Bing Crosby in it. And he's working with the studio Paramount. At this moment in time, there's a really big danger to film, and that's television. And all of the studios are working really hard to develop new cinematic technologies in order to compete with television. So what do they come up with? They come up with widescreen, because television is tiny and enclosed. But the movie screen, it's enormous, it's immersive, it's celebratory. So they actually use White Christmas as the first film for VistaVision, which is Paramount's own widescreen technology. And we see this experimentation then with this particular form in a holiday movie. It's really, really incredible.
Well, let's give a listen to a little bit of White Christmas out in 1954.
I'd not be bad at that, you know, the snow-covered slopes, skiing, Christianas and the stemming and the plotzing and the shushing, hot buttered rum, light on the butter, and snow.
Snow, snow,
snow, snow,
snow. It won't be long before we'll all be there with snow.
And the idea, so you can see the picture he's painting of the snow, and Hollywood took advantage of their technology to do something, it sounds like, that you couldn't replicate on the TV.
That's absolutely right. And of course, when you're shooting a film, you're not shooting this Christmas film in December. You're shooting it on set in, you know, May or June. So it's also a great opportunity to demonstrate what kinds of miraculous behind the stage illusions you can develop, such as snow falling in spring.
And probably in California too, Southern California.
California too, exactly.
We are talking about the history of the holiday movie. Jocelyn Sapaniak-Agilles is with us, Assistant Professor of English and Film Studies at UW-Milwaukee. You can join in if you can dial quickly at 800-642-1234. If you have a favorite holiday movie that you count on watching each and every year, 800-642-1234, or post on the Ideas Network Facebook page. We got some comments from people on Facebook. Diane writes that Love Actually is her favorite Christmas movie. Brandy says, I like so many as long as they're not those hokey Hallmark Channel movies. And Sarah writes, when it comes to holiday classics, it's almost like when you're asked which of your kids is your favorite. And I love, a lot of people, I think, have traditions, Jocelyn, of movies, old or new, coming back and watching them again and again over the years. Can you talk about how, I don't know, we've adopted them into our lives now that we can watch them at home?
Yeah, I think we think of holiday movies as particularly relevant to this moment when streaming media is the way that we consume most of our film and television, right? But there's actually a long history as well of developing a relationship with a holiday movie at home, and that's television syndication. So I think about a film like It's a Wonderful Life, which now is kind of like the ne plus ultra of holiday films. But it's really not until about the mid-80s that it becomes really known as such a celebrated holiday film. And that's because it was shown as a Christmas movie every year from that time on. It was purchased for TV syndication in the 50s, but it's really in the 80s that it begins to be shown on television over and over and over again. And that's how we begin to associate them, I think, with the holiday. In part, it's due to television scheduling. So as much as we think about this time of streaming media as the only time when we would consume film at home, there's also a longer historical legacy that occurs with television syndication and purchasing of movies from Hollywood to show on TV.
Well, speaking of It's a Wonderful Life, I think Charlotte in Evansville wants to tell us something about that. Charlotte, hi.
Hi. My mom always watched It's a Wonderful Life growing up, and as a kid, I hated it because it was black and white. And now as an adult, I appreciate it, and I look forward to it every year.
Are you someone who's going to share it with the next generation, Charlotte, even though they may push
Absolutely.
Back on the black and white?
Yeah, I've got a 5 and a 2-year-old, and I think I'll introduce them this year.
Fantastic, Charlotte. Thank you so much for sharing that. So, yeah, with people going back and watching older movies now, Jocelyn, it isn't all the new stuff. A lot of these are classics. And our caller there, Charlotte, got over her aversion to black and white over time.
I love that. I think that's so charming. And it says something about the nostalgic aspects of cinema, right? Film isn't just something that we go see and we forget about, but it becomes a part of our holiday traditions. And it also becomes a part of our larger American culture. And it's a really, sometimes that's a troubling thing. But I think in this instance, it's a really kind of lovely and wonderful thing to think about.
Thanks for that call. We're going out to Glenn in Stoughton. Glenn, hi.
Hi there.
What did you want to bring up, Glenn?
Well, I will say, first of all, It's a Wonderful Life was the theme of my wedding.
Huh. Okay.
However, I want to talk about Arthur Christmas, an animated film that I don't think that many people are familiar with. It was really fantastic.
I don't remember that. I'm looking it up right now. Thanks for calling in. It's got some great names as the voices, Jim Broadbent, James McAvoy, and I love Bill Nighy does a voice. I have not seen this one. Jocelyn, are you familiar with this animated one, Arthur Christmas?
I am not. I have to confess I'm not. I'm familiar with, you know, Rudolph the Red-Nosed Reindeer, though.
Oh, Aardman Animations. They did the dog and the guy. I'm blanking on the names now.
Nick Park, the creator of Aardman Animation. He's so wonderful. Wallace and Gromit.
Wallace and Gromit.
So
I should have that.
I love Nick Park. Yeah.
Thank you so much for that call. Well, I want to give a listen to another clip here and talk about songs and movies. This is a little bit of the film Meet Me in St. Louis and a song with some staying power. Here's a listen to Judy Garland.
Have yourself merry little Christmas, make the Yuletide gay. Next
a lot
year,
of, a lot of the things, Jocelyn, that are standbys in our Christmas Carol repertoire now, I think, came out of the older movies, didn't they?
They did. And anytime I get to hear Judy Garland's voice, I just get shivers down my spine. It's so delightful to get to listen to her. And that song has such a fascinating history behind it. Meet Me in St. Louis comes out end of 1944, beginning of 1945. And of course, it's towards the end of American involvement in World War II. Vincente Minnelli directs it. It's an MGM Technicolor spectacular musical. And it has this really fascinating aspect to it, which is that it's about, it's a nostalgia for 1904. It all takes place in St. Louis in 1904 around the World's Fair. And then there's this song that Judy Garland sings, Have Yourself a Merry Little Christmas. When you listen to this song in the film, it is deeply, deeply sad. And that's because the song is actually about soldiers being away for the holidays and not getting to be with your family over Christmas. One of the lines was changed over time. To make it a little bit less sad. But it's just got such a sad, melancholic, but I think right now, very, very timely message for all of us that next year we might get to be together again.
Another movie our listeners mentioned, well, we heard from Dee on Facebook. She shared a few favorites, The Bishop's Wife, White Christmas, Elf, and A Christmas Story. I want to take a listen to a classic scene from that last one, A Christmas Story.
Are you kidding? stick my tongue to that stupid pole. That's dumb.
That's because you know it'll stick.
You're full of it.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah.
Black double dog dare you.
Uh-oh. Upping the ante there. And this one, I seem to dimly remember, Jocelyn, this one spread in part because it was available on VHS tape, and that's a lot of why that caught on as a holiday tradition. Am I remembering right?
Absolutely. This is one that I grew up with. I was born in 78, so I watched A Christmas Story over and over and over again every Christmas when I was a kid. So that's another example of how distribution affects how we consume media and how we associate it with different holidays. But let me tell you a really funny fact about A Christmas Story, which is that the director, Bob Clark, he made a bunch of other films, but he made one of my favorite Christmas films, which is Black Christmas from 1974, which is about, it's a slasher film about a series of murders in a sorority house over Christmas. And then he goes on to direct A Christmas Story almost a decade later. It's really, really funny.
Yeah, maybe I won't spend Christmas with you. You take it in a weird direction. No, but I want to talk about now 2020. You mentioned how the Have Yourself a Merry Little Christmas has new meaning in a year where people can't spend time together. I saw a thing where one Hallmark Christmas movie this year had to make their you know, climactic kissing scene. They figured out a way to do it with plexiglass between the actors. Can you talk about the holiday movie in this year of COVID-19?
Yeah, I think so many of us have had to learn how to find solace in things that we didn't necessarily expect to find it in. And this year, so many of us are going to be separated from our families. My family is in Baltimore, and I'm not going to get to see them, and I'm very sad about it. But we still have the opportunity to watch things together, to think about them together, and to talk about them together. And I think maybe this can be a source of comfort in a year where things are a little bit difficult. And I think we do well to listen to Judy Garland a little bit and dream that next year our troubles will be far away and we'll all get to hug our loved ones once again.
It's a great place to leave it, Jocelyn. Thanks a lot for joining us again.
Thanks so much for having me.
Jocelyn Sapaniak-Gillies is assistant professor of English and film studies at UW-Milwaukee. She's the author of the book The Optical Vacuum, Spectatorship, and Modernized American Theater Architecture. She joined us for a look at the history of the holiday movie genre. Keep sharing your favorites over at the Ideas Network Facebook page.